Welcome to Take It From Us with host Kent Johns. Real people, real voices, real lives. Discussing mental health, addiction and disability in the community. Your weekly window to the real world. Welcome to Take It From Us.
From us, welcome into our program for another week here. Please leave us a note. Of course, you know how to do this now. Get to our website, tifuradio.org. Plus, of course, you can jump on our Facebook page as well. Leave us a note. Or if there's anyone that you would like us to interview on this program, if someone's out there doing some great work, or you think that we need to shine a light on a particular area, particularly around mental wellbeing and addiction, please let us know, tifuradio.org. We have a couple of really interesting guests on our program, a focus on dyslexia today. First up, though, I just wanted to talk about making mistakes and then going easy on ourselves, because I think we've all got this tendency, haven't we, to be tough. We're really tough and brutal on ourselves when we make mistakes. I had a friend last week who made a fairly significant oversight at work, and she was really beating herself up about this. She felt terrible because she'd let her colleagues down. And I know that feeling when you let other people down in a work capacity and they have to bear the brunt or they have to take the heat for your mistake. It's a horrible feeling. But as I said to her, look, it's probably the sort of mistake you'll only make once. And take heart from the fact that you won't make that error again. I don't know whether really that was what she wanted to hear, but I was just doing my best to be a friend. But she was agonizing about this and feared quite a big backlash from a couple of her colleagues. She started to catastrophize, which is easy to do. My error will mean A, B, C, and D. That's how she was talking. And I told her not to let it ruin her weekend and to go easy on herself. Easy for me to say that, but she was the one that was hurting because the mistake that she'd made, she was fairly certain, was of huge significance. She'd actually identified her own error, but then it was too late for her to correct it in time for a publication. So that's what had happened. She went, oh, that's right. Oh, I forgot to do this. And anyway, she got hold of the person affected, who was extremely supportive. See what's happening here? He was extremely supportive. Not only that, he actually downplayed the mistake to start with and said, look, it doesn't actually matter, so don't even worry about it. And quickly I jumped to the moral of the story, because she did the right thing. She owned up to her mistake as soon as she realised it. And then the key thing is that we have to do here, I think, is to try and not fear the worst, because the worst thing probably won't eventuate. And a lot of us catastrophise these days. In fact, most of us do. It's a form of stress. It's a form of anxiety where we fear the worst. And how many times does this happen where we immediately jump to the worst-case scenario, right? You can picture something going wrong here in your own head. What happens is we jump to the worst-case scenario. And what happens is things are not as bad as they seem. More often than not, things are not as bad as they seem. And, of course, we carry a negativity bias with us that we think in that moment, well, of course it'll go as bad as we think, because it always does. Always happens to me. It always goes wrong. I've never got this right. Yeah, I'm doomed. But because we have that negativity bias, we can't rationalise the fact that actually most of the time things are not as bad as they seem. Most of the time when we make mistakes, things don't end up being as bad as what we think they will be. And I reckon if we actually all sat down, and thank goodness we don't actually do this, but if we took stock and actually took note and did a running tally, we would know that that's actually not the case. And I say thank goodness that we don't actually do this, because can you imagine the amount of time and agony you would take on looking to tally up all of the times that you did something wrong or you thought something and then try to figure out whether it would actually come true, and if it in fact did, how bad was it? But I think most of the time, things are not as bad as we think they actually are. It turned into a weekend that wasn't ruined for my friend. So I was laughing when she called me on Sunday and said, hey, look, by the way, I just thought you might be interested. You know that giant mistake, that awful muck-up that I made last week? And I said, yeah, I do. What happened? Oh, it was fine. No problem at all. So she had a good laugh about it, and she was greatly relieved. And I said to her, well, I threw my coaching hat on. I couldn't help myself and asked a question. I said, hey, look, any good learnings out of this for you? And she said, yeah, not to get too wound up too early. I thought things would be a hell of a lot worse, and it turns out they were not. And I thought, yeah, I'm taking that as a learning as well. Let's try and not catastrophize when we don't need to. All is well that ends well. Our first guest, though, on Take It From Us today has studied dyslexia now for many decades. His name is Lawton King. He's published a brand new book in which he shares his understanding of the dyslexic mind from his own lived experience, both as a dyslexic child and an angry adolescent, but also now as a therapist and an author. It's not his first book that he's published on the topic, but this is one that has a wide-ranging scope, and it's called Inside the Dyslexic Mind. It's a resource for parents and for teachers and for dyslexic people themselves. So it's a warm welcome to Lawton King, who joins us on Take It From Us. Lawton, we teed this up, I know, a few weeks ago, and I've been looking forward to talking to you about this fascinating insight that you have for us, and welcome into Take It From Us. How are you doing?
We've got an absolutely stunningly beautiful day, and that's always a good start.
Fantastic. You've spent 45 years working with dyslexics. You've written a book. It's called Inside the Dyslexic Mind. It's a resource, but I guess it's for anybody who's interested to have a read. Who have you written this book for?
That's a really, really good question. I've actually written four books. This is the fourth in the series. Taken me 40 years. This book is written for the parents, for the teachers, for the researchers and academics, but also for the children themselves, because these children have got to live their entire lives being dyslexic. And if they don't understand it, then they're going to have the same difficulties, the same nightmares that I have always had. And it's my nightmares. I'm 74 years old and I still get nightmares about my childhood. And they are what keeps me going in this whole endeavor.
So is this book written for them to read or to try to read themselves, or is it for others to help them read or to read to them?
All of the above. It's actually really phenomenal, the number of children who get in touch with me, 9, 10, 11-year-olds, saying they have read my books cover to cover. Being dyslexic, I have a certain style of writing, and it seems to suit dyslexic people to read. And this is one of the difficulties I've had in the past, that publishers have said, gosh, no, we're not publishing that. We've got to rewrite the whole thing. And so I say, no way, because you rewrite it, the dyslexic people will not be able to read it.
They're missing the point.
They are totally missing the point, yeah. So it's been a long battle, but a thoroughly worthwhile one. And I'm hoping this book is going to get the reception, first of all here in New Zealand and Australia, and then anywhere else around the world where we use the Roman lettering system. I don't know about other places like in Asia where they use a completely different system, or in the Mediterranean countries, but the English-speaking and the Roman print is where I see this being relevant.
Tell us about your own story, living with dyslexia and how it's affected your life, all of the good, the bad, the warts and all of you. And when were you aware, Lawton, that?
Oh, I was super aware from the age of about 5 years on that I was just dumb and stupid. And I had teachers who were very happy to tell me that I was dumb and stupid. and that I was never paying attention. I was always wandering off in my fantasy. That made school horrendous. I was always in trouble. I couldn't understand instruction. And I presume we'll get in a moment to why that is. But it made life such a nightmare that I learnt not to sleep at night. I would stay awake all night because if I closed my eyes, I might go to sleep and then I would have nightmares. And the nightmares were horrific. They're not as common now, only two or three times a week. But they are still horrific. They are still very ugly. It's not a fun way to go. And I don't want other kids to have to live through what I have lived.
Tell us about the frustrations with being misunderstood.
As a child, you naturally want to please your parents. That's a built into nature. But when my parent says something to me, well, let's start a little bit back from that. The dyslexic person, I liken him to a diesel engine. Perfectly good engine, but it runs on different fuel from most cars. Most cars run on petrol. Well, in exactly the same sense in terms of the division, most people, and probably you as a radio announcer, think in language. You process information in language. You read it, you write it, you talk it, you swap it, you think it, you ask questions, you answer questions, all in language. But the dyslexic does not. But you have two pieces of brain above your left eye. You have your language processing brain. But above your right eye, you have your pictorial brain, your image-based thinking, hence our imagination. Now, if I say a word like tennis racket, your language brain picks it up, yep, I understand that concept, sends it across the corpus callosum to your pictorial brain, and up jumps a picture of a tennis racket. So if I say teddy bear, you've got a teddy bear. Okay? Except if you're Kim Hill. Kim says, I've never had a picture in my head in my life, but look at her mastery of language. So I liken dyslexic children to diesels. But the diesels are sitting in an institution called school where everything is based on language.
Yeah.
Absolutely everything. Now, that's fine for the people who are language thinkers. But those of us who are not have difficulty. Now, remember I said tennis racket? You get a picture of a tennis racket. Okay, how about this word? Perhaps. What's the picture? Common word. Come on, try a little harder. You're not trying hard enough. You're not
applying
yourself.
There's no picture. Yeah.
Now you're just making excuses. Can you remember from school the way the teachers responded to us? Lawton doesn't apply himself. He's not motivated. He's not trying hard enough. He's too easily distracted. Nobody said, I wonder what happens inside his head. So if the teacher is or the parent is using language that has pictures, the child can climb on board. But if the instructor is not using linguistic language, then we miss out on a lot of it. And we sit there and we struggle trying to make sense of the sentence, finally think, nah, doesn't make any sense. We look up and everybody's gone to lunch. I'm the only person sitting in the classroom. Now, I'm exaggerating just a little, but that is what it is like. It's incredibly lonely, unbelievably frustrating, depressing, self-concept, down through the floorboards, and in the end, you think, nah, I'm out of this. And so you disengage. Now, the disengaging is self-protection. And when teachers tell me that a child is not motivated, I say, sorry, teacher, you don't understand motivation. The child is not motivated to keep on failing. He is motivated to self-preserve. And this is why we are currently seeing so much disengagement in the classroom. The interesting thing is teachers don't understand this because they have not been taught about the difference, dyslexic and whatever. The researchers don't understand it because the language system worked perfectly for them. And my professor from my last degree at Auckland University used to say to me, "Don't tell me how children learn. I was a child once. I have not forgotten." Now, this is a professor, PhD, highly intelligent. She could not conceive that some people don't think the way that she thought. Yes, you did now. So, yes, in the end, you get angry.
I can imagine. I can imagine, Lawton. Do we have a number, best guess, as to a percentage here? I'm thinking we probably have more dyslexic children than we think we do. Would that be right?
You're absolutely onto it, yes. About 12 to 15%. Have some degree of dyslexia. Like anything, you can be severely dyslexic or mildly so, and that will to some degree depend on the brain power, the motor under the bonnet. It'll also depend on the stable of the vehicle, like is this a professional family or is this a family that just live maybe more mobile and the kid goes to several different schools. And I've forgotten completely where I was going, but that's another common factor of dyslexia.
12 to 15% of children.
12 to 15%. But just interestingly, what percentage would you guess at dyslexic people in our prisons?
Well, I know the answer because I've read a lot of your book, and this blew me away. And not only the number, but the percentage of prisoners who identify as being left-hand dominant. Can you give us the two statistics together here? Because I think our listeners will be genuinely troubled by this.
Yes, I will. Now, first of all, I've got to say I cannot verify these numbers. They were given to me. But 64% of our prison population are apparently registered as being left-handed. Now, that's the same in Australia, the same in Canada, the same in the USA, and the same in the UK. Within a percentage or two, same figures.
And does that mean they are likely to be more creative thinkers?
That goes with it, yes, because the left-handedness throws a person into their right brain. Now, the academics will disagree with me, and that's fine. They're allowed.
Okay.
They haven't had to live with this. But let's get back to the dyslexia. 84%, apparently, of our prison population are dyslexic. Now, you and I know it's common knowledge that our prison population have a very, very low literacy rate. We also know that if we somehow bring that literacy rate up and we teach them to read and write in prison, their tendency is not to come back because our society passes everybody through the gateway of reading and writing ability. It is such an important part of our society. I can't see that it could be otherwise. So we have to find mechanisms to help these children learn. Before we can find a mechanism, we've got to understand the way they think. Not only understand it, we've also got to accept that that is the way they think. Currently, the implicit message is that there is something wrong with the brain of the dyslexic person. It needs adjusting. It needs aligning. It needs maybe medication. Maybe it needs training. And I am saying there is absolutely nothing wrong with my diesel engine. Absolutely nothing. See, to me, dyslexia is not a reading and writing problem. It's not a learning problem. It is a teaching problem.
Mm.
And it's a teaching problem because the teachers have never been taught what the ins and outs of dyslexia are. Now, who's to blame for this? Nobody except me. If I had been born 100 years earlier, we would be 100 years further down the track. The academics are not to blame, because what I am saying makes absolutely no sense to them.
Well, it makes sense to me in this regard. There's nothing wrong with a diesel engine. It's just different to a petrol engine. Therefore, there's nothing wrong with dyslexia. It's an attribute that is different from those of us who are considered neurotypical. Like, there's not a problem with this. But we have viewed this as a problem and an issue and something that we've tried so hard to fix. And the harder we've tried, potentially the worse we've made it.
You're onto it. Absolutely onto it. What the academics do is they look at people who have succeeded in school and they say, what was it that led to success? They never, ever go out and find the dyslexic failures, grab them off the street corner and say, what was it about school that failed you? See, I don't think these children fail. I think we fail them. They don't fall between the cracks. We push them between the cracks. And we do this in our intolerance and in our belief that everybody thinks the same way, which is just overtly not the case. So that's what my book is about. Mm. It is, I've got 21 case studies that I start off with. And I'm outlining what the presentation is in these individual cases. They're all different. The interesting thing is that I don't get children referred to me because they're not doing well at school. Typically, I don't get children referred to me because they're having difficulty with their behavior. They come to me because they've threatened suicide. One kid had tried suicide 7 times and he was only 7 years old. Now, just come back a little way, because I want to give you one of the really hidden, insidious elements of dyslexia. I asked you to think of a tennis racket. You thought of a tennis racket. Now, be tolerant with me here. This time, don't think of a banana.
Well, it's impossible. You think of it.
You thought of a banana? Look, I asked you not to think of a banana. I'm going to give you another chance at this. Don't think of a stepladder.
Yeah.
Trying hard enough.
I hear you. I empathize with that. Yeah.
Now, listen to this. You have a 3-year-old. The 3-year-old has a glass of orange juice. The kid is walking across the brand spanking new carpet in your house. What do you say to the 3-year-old?
What we should say is, please walk carefully. So it's an affirmative instruction. The moment we say don't, our brain switches to it.
Yes. Now, what I've just demonstrated to you is that we actually hypnotize children to do the very things we don't want them to do. If I say to you, don't think of a stepladder, I have put a stepladder into your head. When I say to the child, don't spill your drink, the picture in your head is?
Spill the drink.
Spilling a drink. Now, that's hypnosis. That's old-fashioned hypnosis. That's how we train the All Blacks. Doesn't always work, but that's how we try. Mm. When we use language that starts off with a don't, shouldn't, never, can't, any of those, we are actually hypnotizing the children. Now imagine the father coming into home on a wet winter's night, storming in the door, grabbing his 10-year-old kid by the jacket and saying, how many times do I have to tell you? Don't leave your bike in the middle of the driveway. Now, the intensity of that experience is going to lock that kid, despite the fear, into leaving his bike in the middle of the driveway. The 7-year-old who had tried suicide 7 times, failed every time, fortunately, said to me, I'm a bad, evil person. Whatever my mum and my dad says to me, if they tell me not to do something, I do it straight away. I don't know why. I don't understand this. I know I shouldn't, but I do. He was not my client. The parents were my client. They, fortunately, were intelligent, motivated people. We spent half an hour together, and this child's situation changed completely. Now, that kid had been through psychiatrists, psychologists, speech and language therapists, all sorts of people. They were trying to treat the child for a hidden difficulty. It was the parents and a common linguistic style. It just needed somebody to understand the way the child thinks, to understand the way the parents talk, put the two together and undo the knot.
Great work. And the words shouldn't, don't, they carry negative connotations too, don't they?
They do.
Which, yeah, and that goes into our own heads too when we say, don't do, oh, I shouldn't be doing this, or don't you know you should be doing better? We can harm ourselves with that way of thinking, can't we?
We do. We undermine ourselves, our own potential, constantly, yes.
Yeah. We're with Lawton King is with us on Take It From Us today. He's just published a brand new book, Inside the Dyslexic Mind. Lawton, I wanted to ask you about your five-year tour of New Zealand, and you came away having learned two big things here, two dynamics. One is that the stigma around dyslexia is still way too powerful and too potent.
Yes.
And two, which I think we could all understand and we could probably wrap our heads around that, but the second point that you realised is that we are placing too high an emphasis on the way that school is being taught as opposed to learning about our students and how they actually work.
Yes, that is absolutely true. What I work with the children one-to-one, and what I learnt from the children was that it is not what we need to add to our teaching package. It's not a technique that we need to sharpen up. It's basically the things we need to stop doing. The things that we have assumed are best practice for teaching, so often we need to back right off those and make the teacher's role actually lighter rather than heavier. Primary school teachers are very, very motivated to work progressively, productively with children. They have the beginning of the whole educational process in their hands, and these people are dedicated. Hey, look, you wouldn't become a primary school teacher for the money. You wouldn't do it for the hours. The hours are horrendous. You probably wouldn't even do it for the company. They do it because they are dedicated. Lock themselves in rooms with 30 smelly kids every day. Horrendous noise. It's not a fun activity. These people, I have huge admiration for them. But we need to assist them, support them to do what they are good at doing. Now, that's my job. I'm not here to write programs for the teachers. My job is a 1 foot in dyslexia, 1 foot in academia, and to clarify the situation going on. Any researcher would acknowledge that the first task of your marketing is to understand your market, understand your client. Look, I'm sorry, but we have failed in this regard. We don't go to the children who fail and ask them how they failed. If we're going to interview children, we go to the children who succeed, for goodness sake. Research done on dyslexia commonly uses university students as the research subjects. Now, if you are trying to get information about dyslexia and how children work that ends up in failure, there is no point in going to university students who are a select group. Anything you find out there is going to be misleading. So that's why I end up writing this book.
Can I ask you something personal, Lawton? Do you ever stop and ponder how it is that you've got to where you're at, where you're publishing books, you're writing books, you're highly intellectual, you understand both sides of this discussion that we're having, and you've come through the same system that a lot of us have come through, and you've done it whilst being dyslexic?
Yeah.
And you've succeeded.
Well, I hope so. I hope so. Yep, to answer your question, it's actually very, very simple for me. I am perhaps a little arrogantly very, very sure that I was put on the face of the earth for a very particular reason. This is my job. I'm not allowed to not do my job. I have a very strong spiritual side. I wouldn't describe it as religious, but it's a very strong spiritual side, and therein lies my commitment. I am put here with all the resources that I need, with all the motivation that I need to do a particular job. So, hey, I'm going to be here until I get it done.
Yeah. But, I mean, you're very purpose-driven to do this.
Very, very. To the point where I'm a pain in the butt for a lot of people, a lot of my friends.
I can, but you know what? If people don't push back against the establishment, there'd never be progress. We actually need more people like yourself, dare I say.
Well, not quite like me, but...
Well, look, it's been great to have you on. It's been just wonderful to chat, and, you know, the book's great, and I wish you nothing but success. And I'd like to, can you give us a reason to be hopeful, a reason to be optimistic that the right people are listening to what you're saying and to what your learnings and just reality, what we're seeing?
Yes, the good part is radio and video attract the people who have difficulty with reading. And, yes, we're getting a huge uptake from radio stations around the country, people like yourself. And I am quite sure that a lot of your listeners will say, I'm not dyslexic. School never worked for me. Now they might start thinking about it again. What I would say to them is, yes, my books are now available in all the shops. They're $35 each. But you can go down to your local library and ask for a copy. And if it's not in the library is obliged to get you a copy. And you get the book out of the library, you keep it for a month, you read it, and you put it back in the library, it's there for somebody else. Or in the meantime, the library might have got two copies. I know Invercargill Library actually had seven copies of three of my books. That's the way to get the word out there into the community. I'm very happy for people to buy their own, but it's not everybody who's got $35 to buy a book.
Sure.
And that's what they cost to get to the market.
Hmm. But the Ministry of Education, how are they listening?
There's a difference between listening and hearing.
Yeah. Right.
It's a complication to them. Yes, they will have listened. They will have heard to a degree, but it's not something that they want to pick up. A few years ago, I issued every politician in the National and Labour parties a free book. Sent them all a free book. I know Jacinda's got hers, probably under the bed. But I never got any responses from it. And I went down to a think tank meeting in Wellington, jumped on a plane, shot down there, demanded that they hear me. They did. Oh, yes, thank you for your very valuable input, Mr. King. That was it. There is political disinterest. It's not a sexy thing at all.
Right.
It's far more sexy to say, yes, we're going to get heavy with the people who keep on breaking into shops. That's far more sexy. That's front page of the Herald. My stuff, not.
Is there a country that's doing this well that we could aspire to be like?
Every country where I have either gone or done my best to research where they're up to has got points of brilliance. And mostly, just sideline. Right. But the brilliance is often motivated by commercial interest. There is a really sad tendency in our society for people to see other people's difficulties as a source of financial income. We monetize illness. That is a product of the way our society has developed. And that's sad. And I really don't want that to happen with this.
Mm. Something to ponder. Hey, Lawton, thank you so much for joining our program. I hope teachers, the copy that this is what I'll promise you, my copy, once I've finished it completely, I'm going to shoot around the corner and give it to the headmaster of my local school, who I know well, and I will insist that he read it.
Lovely.
How's that?
Thank you for your support and for your energies.
Thank you. Thanks, Lorden. Have a great day. That is Light Surrounding Me by the Kiwi band Evermore. It's been a little while since we've checked in with the Ember Innovations team on Take It From Us. Joining us now is Emily Preston with some exciting news. The team have got a new project that they're ready to launch, and they're keen to have a chat to us and tell us a little bit about that. So, Emily, thank you so much for joining us on the program. How are you today?
I'm good, thank you. Great to be here, Kent. Thanks for inviting me on.
Are you going well with life at the moment?
Life is good. The sun is shining. It's all going well.
So what is happening at Ember Innovations? We haven't checked in with you and your team for a little while now. So what's new? What's there to report back on?
Lots of exciting things are going on. So we're in the midst of a bit of action. We've done a lot of thinking and planning, and now we're actually doing some really cool mahi with a bunch of young people and adults and people doing good work across North Auckland. So that's the kind of area from the bridge all the way up to Wellsford, that whole area. And we're looking at the well-being of young people in particular, doing a piece of work where we're looking at what's already happening that's really good. There's lots of great, powerful initiatives already underway, people doing great work. But we know that young people are still struggling, so we're trying to explore what we can do to amplify the good and, you know, add things where there may be some gaps.
Yeah, I mean, this is a question I probably ask of many people, but it's always good to get different perspectives. How is the well-being of young people?
Well, we know that young people are struggling at the moment and that picture is actually getting worse. There's a lot of mental distress in our young people in Rangatahi. But behind those kind of reports, and there's lots of great research out there, which is quite sobering reading, are, you know, the stories of individuals who have their own experiences and their own perspectives and their own things that matter to them. So that's a big part of what we've been doing here. We've been, you know, starting point was, we know this is a challenge, but we've gone and talked to young people and the adults in their lives about what that really means in their situation and what they're looking for and what would help them to flourish and thrive and, you know, feel positive and good about their lives and their futures.
Yeah, because as a young person, you really should be flourishing. Young people should be flourishing. It's really disheartening, isn't it, to hear that so many of them aren't?
Yeah, absolutely. And we all want young people to flourish. I mean, there's nobody who doesn't want that outcome, but it's complicated. It can be a hard time in your life and there's a lot going on. So sometimes we need a little bit of extra help.
Yeah, for sure, and we all need help. But as part of your role unpacking some of those complications and working out how they align together and why we're seeing what we're seeing?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you look at there's some great research out there already, and it covers kind of all sorts of things, because like mental health and wellbeing is so broad. So, you know, things like, you know, cost of living stuff, poverty is obviously a massive factor, but all the way through to the influence of social media and, you know, crime and climate anxiety. There's so many different things which interact here. So it's challenging to find those specific places to focus on. But luckily we haven't had to guess or figure that out by ourselves, because we've been working with, you know, these young people and youth leaders and teachers and others who can tell us what's real in their lives.
And what are they telling you?
Well, a lot of different things, but there were three key themes which have come out of it, which we're kind of looking for people to work with us on. One of them is around early intervention and prevention. We heard a lot of stories from young people who didn't meet the criteria for certain sorts of support. They were told they were not in a bad enough situation yet to kind of go away and you know, try and get on with things. And really their story quite often was that they just waited until they got worse and then had to come back again. So it was nothing to really help them in the meantime. The second area that we heard a lot about was there are people who are trying to support young people, and young people know who they want to get that support from, but those people are often struggling as well. So if you're experiencing a bit of distress, and maybe your family also is, and your parents are struggling to cope anyway, then they're not in a position to support you with the best will in the world. And same with teachers. You know, teachers are on strike because they are undervalued, underpaid, and expected to do all sorts of things. So putting this on teachers as another part of their job without enough support and enough resource isn't going to work. So we hear those stories a lot. So we've got a theme around supporting the supporters. How can you help those people who young people turn to for help to actually be in a position to do that without that jeopardizing their own well-being? And then we have another theme, which is the probably less exciting to a lot of us, but great for a nerd like me, which is around how you kind of join up the different parts of the system. So as I said earlier, there's people doing brilliant stuff all over the place, but they're often frustrated because they don't have anywhere to refer people to who they've worked with, and they just can't work with any longer. They just don't have the capacity to do that, or There's people who they don't hear about who would benefit from what they're doing. So that bit about how we can support people's journey, whatever stage they're at, whatever is going on in their lives, and make sure they don't fall through these gaps is another area we're looking at.
That's great stuff that you've been able to get it into three categories, because I guess it gives you some clarity, because you're hearing a million different stories and all of those societal factors that you mentioned to throw in the mix, not to mention trauma, which clearly plays a big role as well, and past experience and the fears that we've all got. To get it into three, I guess it enables you and the team to focus on specific areas and the kinds of support that you can start to provide.
Yeah, absolutely. And they're still really broad areas. I mean, there's a million different things that could fit under any of those. But yeah, it is helpful. And I think what it also does is it allows us to show that we are having a kind of broad approach and a kind of systems approach to this. So it's not just about, you know, let's get a few apps and throw them into the mix, although that might be part of it. But also those things like, you know, how can you enable better data flow and better collaboration, and, you know, help people to actually, when they're working kind of 80 plus hour weeks, how do you support them to actually collaborate? Because that's another thing that takes a lot of time.
You know, I work as a coach, and I know this to be true, that we can throw as much science and reason and logic and studies at them, and it would all make sense, but people need tools. They actually need to have a suite of tools at their disposal, don't they? Where they can go, you know what, maybe today I need to pull this particular lever. Tomorrow I might do something a little bit different.
Yeah, totally agree.
And you mentioned prevention. There's that phrase, it's not the metric system, an ounce of prevention is more effective than a pound of cure, or words to that effect. And so I look at the two that you've come up with there, number one and two, prevention, and then also supporters struggling. If us as supporters, and I'm a parent and I coach young guys as well, like if I focus for me on prevention, then I am going to be in a better position to help them look after themselves. So I think there is definitely a link there between prevention and us as supporters. If we were to look after ourselves better and focus on our own well-being and put it right up there at the top as a priority, then through prevention, then we are only going to be in a stronger position to help those younger people who also need a steer in that direction.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think quite often we can let our own well-being suffer because we're just focused elsewhere without even realising it's happening. So alongside those themes, we've got some kind of, we call them red flags and green flags we developed with our co-design group, which is some young people and teachers and youth workers and various people. And one of those that will cut across all three of these areas is around how are we taking care of everybody's well-being in this mix. So it's not about supporting young people's well-being at the cost of anybody else's. That doesn't help anybody.
Yeah, you're onto it. Well, look, if there's anything else that you think we can add here, let us know, Emily. We'd like to keep in touch. And youth flourishing is what we should be aspiring for that. And I think you're right. There's no one that doesn't want to see that.
And we all have something to offer as well. So because this is, you know, Ember Innovations doesn't have all the answers. We're about kind of convening and amplifying and bringing people together who can do this stuff. So we've got a website. I'll just plug it at the moment.
Go.
So Innovating Wellbeing Solutions, innovatingwellbeing.solutions is the website that has more information on the challenge. If you are someone with an idea that might fit, who would like some support to figure out how to do that really well and have all the impact you could possibly have, you can sign up there. And if you're someone who just wants to support this, whether that's with your kind of technical skills or your lived experience perspective, or you can do their accounts, or you just want to give some feedback or test things, all of those things are super valuable. This is definitely a whole of community kind of approach. So you can sign up there as well to be a supporter.
Yeah, and it has to be a whole of community approach, Emily, because no one has all the solutions. And if we did, we wouldn't have such a growing need for for intervention and for help and support and assistance. And I know you and the team there are all enthusiastic and you work really, really hard to try and help people better themselves and have better lives. So thanks for doing what you're doing, and it's great that you joined us on the program today.
Thanks, Kent.
Kiwi song for New Zealand Music Month on Take It From Us. That's a classic, Long Ago by Herbs. Sad news last week, of course, with the passing of Tina Turner, aged 83. And you expect older people to die, and it's sad, but not necessarily tragic. But I have to say, I was like, oh, man. it stung a little bit. Celebrity deaths come, they happen, we know that, but the odd one actually stings a little bit. And I remember a few years ago when Michael Hutchence died from in excess through suicide, which was tragic, and he was my absolute favourite, and that stuck with me for a long time. And then Tom Petty 4 or 5 years ago as well. Some hurt more than others, and I think this one with Tina Turner struck with me because I've loved her music. I've long admired her because of her spirit and her tenacity and the way that she always would attack the microphone, and she's too larger than life. But her songs were brilliant and they were heartfelt and she sang them with such passion. I remember her appearing at the Rugby League Grand Final about 30 years ago. She was part of that amazing campaign as well with Jimmy Barnes, and she just had spunk. You know, if there was one word I could sum up Tina Turner, it would be spunk. And I've just admired her for so many years from such a long way away. And I know she was 83 and I know she had a good life, but it is sad because we've lost a real trailblazer, I think, for female artists in the music industry, and for a grandmother too, and for her legacy, which will be the kids and the grandkids and everything else. She's one day younger than my father. I don't know when I particularly learnt that little stat, but so I've always known that, hey, my father's such an age, Tina's such an age, she's still going strong. Well, she was going strong right up until she died last week, so that for me was quite a sad day. But it's been great to hear so many people talking enthusiastically about what an awesome performer she was and what a great presence she had for a lot of people, and she really had a huge impact. And I think that would be her legacy, the fact that she had such a great impact on so many people all around the world with just made amazing music. And, man, if I've got that sort of energy, you know, at 75 and 80, I'll be pretty bloody stoked. Thanks to Karen, who has produced the program, as always, on Take It From Us today. We've had a couple of great guests on the show, Lawton King and Emily Preston. A special thank you to them. Thank you so much for listening to us as well. And we are back again next week right here.
You've been listening to Take It From Us with host Kent Johns, produced by Karen Murphy, executive producer Andrew Dewhurst, made with the real stories and voices from our community. And for that, we thank you. For more information on anything you've heard on today's show, or for direction on where to seek further advice or assistance, visit our Facebook page, Take It From Us. Scott, you